Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Thanks for joining me on this Thursday. You've seen the headlines. Hundreds of people rallied yesterday at the Capitol to ask Governor Herbert to veto the sex ed bill, House Bill 363. There's a petition drive as well for House Bill 187. Opponents call it the Ag Gag Bill. Proponents call it the Agricultural Operation Interference Bill. In the last portion of the program today, a conversation with Governor Gary Herbert. I'll ask him what he's going to do about these two bills and other bills, as it's his constitutional duty to veto, let go without his signature, or to sign those bills, some 490 bills in all coming out of the 2012 legislative session. But in the first part of the program today, we're going to talk about House Bill 187, which would ban photographing farm operations without permission or under false pretenses. Proponents say it provides needed protections to farm operations. Opponents say this is nothing but a thinly veiled attempt to prevent needed public scrutiny. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I'll be talking with Randy Parker, CEO of the Utah Farm Bureau. And we begin today with Nathan Runkle, founder and executive director of Mercy for Animals. And Nathan Runkle, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
First of all, Mercy for Animals, what's the group?
We are a national animal protection organization, and we work to prevent cruelty to farmed animals and promote compassionate food choices and policies. And undercover investigations is really a central part of our work to expose this abuse and bring animal abusers to justice and help change the landscape in terms of our laws and corporate policies governing the way that farmed animals are treated in this country.
Some of the proponents of House Bill 187 are saying that they need protection by way of this bill because groups like yours have an agenda, which is to drive them out of business.
Well, our agenda is simple, and that's to prevent needless cruelty to farmed animals. And this is a sentiment that is shared by the majority of Americans. Polls show that upwards of 90% of Americans, and that includes those in Utah, believe that farmed animals deserve protection from cruelty. Yet, if we look at the situation, we see that there's not a single federal law that provides protection to animals during their lives on intensive factory farms. And that means that abuse runs rampant, and it's the norm. And every time that we send investigators into these facilities, we find animals kept in cages where they can't even turn around or extend their limbs or lie down comfortably. We see animals being mutilated without any painkillers. And oftentimes we see violent and malicious cruelty by workers. Workers stabbing animals with pitchforks, breaking their tails, slamming them into the ground. And this is abuse that thrives in secrecy. And we feel that this bill is really aimed at shielding animal abusers from public scrutiny. And we need more transparency in food production, not less. We feel that the agriculture industry should be working to offer incentives to whistleblowers, installing cameras in these facilities, and working to strengthen the quite frankly pathetic anti-cruelty laws that we have in this country.
Now, supporters of the bill say this bill protects people. You still are protected if you're taking pictures during a farm tour, or it protects whistleblowers who report illegal practices. And one point proponents of the bill make is that you don't really care about animals if what you do is wait for several weeks to make a video. You should report this immediately to authorities.
Well, a number of points there. We do go directly to authorities. Just a few months ago, we did a case at a Butterball factory farm in North Carolina and went directly to law enforcement, contacted them while our investigators were still in the facility. And we documented workers throwing birds, hitting them over the head with metal pipes, management leaving birds to suffer with huge bloody open wounds. And as a result of our investigation, law enforcement raided the factory farm. Six factory farm workers were arrested and charged with animal cruelty. This is one of many examples of our investigators really serving as the only watchdogs, the eyes and ears that these animals have in these facilities. In terms of whistleblowers, the unfortunate reality is that in many of these facilities, most of the workers are undocumented, they're illegal, so they're incapable of really coming forward and speaking out against this abuse without being deported. Others that are working in these facilities really need the work, and they know that if they come forward and speak out against the abuse, that they could be fired. So there's a lot of issues at stake here, and we see time and again that investigations not only help prevent animal cruelty, but help safeguard our food supply. There was an investigation done in 2008 at a slaughterhouse in California that documented downed dairy cows. These are cows too sick or injured to even stand on their own, being kicked, prodded, pushed with forklifts, and then going onto the kill floor and being slaughtered for meat. These downed dairy cows are at a higher risk of having mad cow disease and salmonella and E. coli, other illnesses that can contaminate our food supply and pose a risk to consumers. It was only after an investigation by the Humane Society of the United States that this abuse was brought to light and that it was ended. Criminal charges were filed, and it resulted in the largest beef recall in U.S. history. 140 million pounds of beef was recalled, including from hundreds of schools nationwide. So we need these investigations, and if we don't have them, the legislature needs to be rectifying the situation by requiring that there be cameras in these facilities, that there be inspections, and quite frankly, we don't have it. And this is just shielding animal abusers, and that's not acceptable.
If you just joined us, we're talking about House Bill 187. It has passed the legislature. It is awaiting Governor Gary Herbert's signature. Later in this program, I'll have a conversation with Governor Herbert where I'll ask him what his intentions are with 187, also with 363, another controversial bill, the sex ed bill, and get the governor's general reaction to the legislative session. Later in this half hour, I'll be talking with Randy Parker from the Utah Farm Bureau. He, of course, will have a very different view on this. Right now, we're talking with Nathan Runkle, founder of Mercy for Animals. You're welcome to join this conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Love to have your comments here. Nathan Runkle, one of the charges that proponents of this bill, one of the reasons they say they need this bill, is they charge that in some cases videos and sound have been manipulated for propaganda purposes.
Well, it's as ridiculous as it sounds. You know, video doesn't lie or take sides. It shows exactly what's taking place in these facilities. And we have a long history of working with law enforcement. We go to them after our investigations. We give them all of our unedited footage. And time and again, they secure warrants. They raid factory farms. They file criminal charges. And that, I think, speaks so highly to the validity of these investigations. And oftentimes these investigations are exposing routine practices that most Americans would find just truly appalling, such as confining pigs in stalls that are only 2 feet wide where they can't even turn around or lie down comfortably, castrating, cutting the tails off of piglets without any painkillers. These are practices that are now starting to be banned in a number of states. We have 8 states nationwide that have banned these tiny gestation crates for pigs. And we'd like to see Utah moving in that direction rather than moving backward and simply throwing shut the doors of these facilities so that consumers can't see what's taking place.
You've cited several instances of animal cruelty. Is this type of thing going on in Utah?
Well, unfortunately, there has not been an undercover investigation that I know of at farm operations in Utah, but we do know that Utah is about the 15th largest pork-producing state in the nation. So we do understand that there are these institutional forms of confinement taking place in Utah, these gestation crates, which, as I said, the pigs can't even turn around, they can't lie down comfortably, they can't walk or engage in the most basic natural behaviors, practice that's being banned in more and more states. We just saw McDonald's coming out saying that they were going to require all of their pork suppliers to phase out this practice. So we feel that we need more transparency in food production, not less, so that we can have a real discussion about how these animals are being treated. And what this bill does, this ag gag bill, is it seeks to stifle this discussion. And we think that it's dangerous. There's a coalition of 27 national organizations representing not only animal protection issues, but food safety, public health, civil liberties, farm organizations that oppose this bill, including the American Civil Liberties Union, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Natural Resource Defense Council, the Whistleblower Support Fund. All of these groups feel that this bill is unconstitutional. It's a violation of freedom of speech and freedom of press.
Now, you've outlined problems. You've told us that whistleblowing, undercover operations are in some cases the only way to expose these abuses. But isn't there on the face of it a problem with somebody going in under false pretenses, in some cases getting hired, right, for this purpose? Isn't there some problem at some level there?
Well, as I said, there's no federal law providing protection to animals during their lives on the factory farm. And what that means is that there are no inspections. So we're essentially relying on industry to self-regulate. And we have seen time and time again that when that is the situation, that profit weighs out over animal protection. And as I described, based on the workforce there, it can be very difficult for whistleblowers to step forward. So investigators of animal protection organizations are oftentimes the only watchdogs that these animals have and for the food supply. Now, our investigators give their real name, their real social security number. They're oftentimes complimented on a job well done. The only difference is that they care about animal welfare when they go into these facilities. And we don't believe that they should be singled out or prosecuted for that. The reality is that farmers that are doing things right open their barn doors and want people to come in and see what's taking place. And this Ag Gag bill, if passed, would really cast a large shadow of doubt, a huge question mark over Utah's agriculture industry of what exactly is going on that this industry doesn't want the American public to see.
Let's go to our first caller, who is April in Salt Lake City. Go ahead with your question or comment, April.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think this legislation is really disturbing. I'm quite troubled by it, and I think it's terrible what they're trying to do to hide what happens in these facilities. And I think, you know, they should have cameras in there to show people that their animals are being treated well.
Thanks, April. We'll get a comment from Mr. Runkle.
I couldn't agree more. You know, the American public deserves to know what's happening in food production, and factory farms are oftentimes the first stage of that food production. And we see that when there is not transparency, not only does animal abuse run rampant, but other criminal behavior. And we really fear that if this law is passed, that not only would animal abuse thrive, but other criminal behavior could start to run rampant in factory farms in Utah, such as environmental violations, safety issues, and that's why we see such a wide variety of organizations joining this coalition opposing this legislation. There's a national poll that was just done that showed that 71% of Americans support these undercover investigations by animal welfare groups. And we've seen some of the leading papers in Utah editorialize against this legislation. So this is a far-reaching problem that impacts all of us.
You just joined us. We're talking with Nathan Runkle, founder of Mercy for Animals. So just a couple more minutes with him. Then we'll be talking with Randy Park from Utah Farm Bureau with an opposite point of view on House Bill 187, which is the official title, Agricultural Operation Interference Bill. The opponents call it the Ag Gag Bill. It would prohibit what proponents of the bill, anyway, would call photographing farm operations without permission or under false pretenses. And you're welcome to join the conversation, as April did, at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can get an email through to us. We'll get that on the air at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. The number, once again, is 1-800-826-1495. Mr. Runkle, how would you characterize these abuses? A small minority of cases in agriculture? A larger minority, a majority of the cases? Where does this fit? Do you think the majority of agricultural producers are doing a good job?
Well, I think that there are two types of abuses. There's one that are institutionalized abuses, as we would call them, and this is the practice of confining animals intensively, mutilating them without painkillers. Things like confining pigs in tiny gestation crates where they can't turn around, confining egg-laying hens in tiny battery cages. These are cages the size of a file drawer cabinet that can confine up to 7 birds. They can't even spread their wings. Confining veal crates in calves where they can't even turn around or lie down comfortably. These are the type of abuses that we see across the board on large-scale production facilities, and we're seeing a growing number of states outlaw these practices. Then we have more physical, sadistic abuse by workers, beating them, stabbing them, slamming them into walls. And unfortunately, we find time and time again with our investigations that these abuses run rampant as well. And I think that's because these workers become very desensitized to the animals as suffering and feeling pain. They become an obstacle and a means to an end to get their job done. So whenever we enter these facilities, we oftentimes do find this abuse, and sometimes it rises to a level of being criminal animal abuse. And this abuse really is allowed to thrive because these industries have shown time and again that they can't self-regulate. And most state anti-cruelty laws, including the one in Utah, specifically exempt farmed animals from much of their protection. So we would like to see legislators spending their valuable time working to improve this situation, to improve food safety, to improve animal protection by making these industries more transparent and holding them accountable, as opposed to simply throwing shut the doors on these facilities and keeping consumers in the dark and essentially creating a safe haven for criminal behavior.
Talking with Nathan Runkel with Mercy for Animals. Later in this half hour, Randy Parker, Utah Farm Bureau. We're talking about House Bill 187, which is officially the Agriculture Operation Interference Bill. Opponents call it the Ag Gag Bill. Let's bring in another caller. This is Jackie from, is it Lewiston, Idaho, Jackie?
No, it's Lewiston, Utah.
Lewiston, Utah. Okay, Jackie, go ahead with your question or comment.
Okay, well, it's a comment, and we've lived here around here for a long time, and I've raised my kids here. I am appalled by what goes on some of the, not so much the smaller farms. The smaller farms are, I think, much more humane areas, and I see a difference in how the animals are treated. But you asked a little earlier about whether it happened in Utah. My kids have all worked on farms as they've grown up as teenagers. Chicken farms, in fact, a couple of my younger kids at one time here worked on some chicken farms, and they didn't last very long because of the inhumanity that was happening with the birds, the way they handled the birds, moved them around. It was very traumatic for my kids, which are, you know, I think that any time that something like that happens to kids that are teenagers, I think if they see that kind of stuff, what does it say about us as human beings? I guess that's kind of my comment on this, is it's out there and nobody really regulates it. I've not seen it. And the smaller farms, I think, do much better. But the bigger the farm, it seems like the more rampant it becomes. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate that. Mr. Runkel, any comments on that?
I agree 100% with Jackie, and that's why we see that some of the smaller farming organizations actually supporting the efforts to fight these ag gag bills. As I said, farmers that are doing things right in a humane fashion are happy to show their facilities to the public. They're happy to be photographed. It's these industrial operations that are abusing animals at an alarming rate that really have a lot to be hidden. And we should be working to address that situation, not keep consumers in the dark.
Reaching the end of our time with Nathan Runkel, should the governor veto the bill, what's your next step? Or not pass the bill, sign the bill. I'm sorry. What would be your next step?
Well, we certainly are calling on the governor to veto this dangerous bill. We feel it's unconstitutional. And if the bill is passed, we, along with a broad coalition of organizations, will be challenging the bill in court. We feel it's the best thing to do for animals and for the American consumer.
And what do you think your chances are there?
Well, The American Civil Liberties Union has said that they, too, agree that this bill is unconstitutional, so we feel that, that we have a good chance of having it repealed. But, of course, we would prefer for us to not have to go down that route by the governor doing the right thing and vetoing this dangerous legislation.
Later in this hour, I'll be talking to the governor. I'll ask him what his plans are with House Bill 187, also House Bill 363, the sex ed bill, and other bills. Nathan Runkle, Mercy for Animals, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And coming up following a brief break, I'll be talking with Randy Parker, CEO of the Utah Farm Bureau. We'll talk, get his views on House Bill 187. That's coming up following a brief break.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan.
Yeah.
Now open Monday through Saturday until 2. Celebrating St. Patrick's Day this week with a signature Reuben sandwich, hand-decorated sugar cookies, and this Thursday through Saturday with Irish soda bread.
Thanks for being with us for Access Utah. We're debating House Bill 187 on this part of the program. Later in the program, a conversation with Utah Governor Gary Herbert. 187 is the Agricultural Operation Interference Bill. The opponents call it the Ag-Gag Bill. We've got that point of view earlier in the program with Nathan Runkle from Mercy for Animals. Now we bring in Randy Parker, CEO of Utah Farm Bureau, to get the opposite point of view. And Mr. Parker, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Remind us what the Utah Farm Bureau Federation is.
Well, we're Utah's largest farm and ranch organization. We represent farmers and ranchers across the state. And nationally, we're the largest in America as well, with organizations in all state organizations in all 50 states.
It was Representative John Mathis, a veterinarian out in the Vernal area, who sponsored the bill. And this bill, my understanding, would prohibit photographing and audio recording of farm operations without permission or under false pretenses. In your view, why was this bill needed?
Well, I think what you just said speaks volumes. This is a very narrow prohibition that was in HB 187. It says that those people that seek through fraudulent applications or so forth employment to get on farms and ranches and then use that undercover activity to malign agriculture is what he was focusing on. Let me start out, Tom, by basically establishing some facts. Farmers and ranchers and Farm Bureau in no way condone abuse or mistreatment of animals of any kind. In fact, veterinarians, animal scientists, and industry representatives have come together to establish species-specific animal care standards. The gentleman previous talked about that there's not standards set. That's absolutely wrong, and those standards are set based on the specific species, and that would be a challengeable offense if somebody didn't meet those industry standards in a court of law.
Does abuse of animals go on in any way, shape, or form in Utah?
Well, you know, that's one of the interesting questions you just asked. If people in the state of Utah are driving down the road, they will see animal agriculture all around them. And here's something I would ask those people as they're driving and witnessing animal agriculture in the open spaces, in the farm fields, and so forth, that if they see an animal in distress, that they would report that. Try the farmer first. If they can't find that, go to the authorities. If they see a problem, report it. We want that to happen, and the proper authorities are law enforcement officers.
And I've been reading a little something that the Farm Bureau put out. That's one complaint you have about the opponents of the bill, right? That you shouldn't be making a video waiting weeks to report this, report immediately. Of course, Mr. Runkle's...
Absolutely, Tom. In fact, I saw one last week as this bill was beginning to take some heat, where somebody had gone by a horse that was in distress down in southern Utah, and they had taken pictures of it for 3 or 4 days, and that's troubling to me. Why in the world didn't that person, when they first saw that horse in stress, under stress, go take that that complaint to law enforcement, and instead of waiting 3 or 4 or 5 days? You know, people that own animals, animal agriculture, they're out among them very regularly, but they may miss some things. So the public's involvement is valuable. Now, let me also clarify something, Tom. When we're talking about animals, you know, there's a big difference between the people that have 2 or 3 horses or a couple of goats and those people that make a living raising animals, you know, from an animal agriculture standpoint. But also, let me take you to a point that I think is critically important here in Utah. The gentleman earlier talked, he used the term factory farms throughout his presentation. 98% of the farms in the state of Utah nationally are owned by families. And almost 85% of the food that comes to market in this country is marketed from families. So that factory farm, that corporate agriculture, is a very small part of the American agriculture landscape.
One of the concerns of opponents of this bill is that I know proponents say that the bill 187 still protects whistleblowers. But opponents are saying that whistleblowers don't have the needed protections.
I would disagree with that. In fact, whistleblowers are protected in the workplace. They're protected from being fired. You know, as I think about this whistleblower issue specifically, I'm thinking last night they talked about a mercury spill 5 years ago up in Weber County and the whistleblower that has brought that to light. Well, you know what? That whistleblower doesn't have pictures of what happened back then. You know, if you're talking about workplace sexual harassment or theft in the workplace, those they don't have cameras going to where that is how they build a case. It's a whistleblower who goes forward, and in a court of law, his word is given. It's not by massaging videos and different things in all cases a whistleblower, and we think from an agriculture standpoint, the same standard can be met.
We had I don't know if you heard our caller Jackie from Lewiston. Is living in a rural area. She says her sons worked on some larger agricultural operations. She made a delineation between the smaller operations and the larger ones. She said they quit. They felt that they were witnessing abuse of birds.
Well, and they do have very strict standards of animal husbandry for birds. But, you know, we need to back up just a little bit, I guess, again, and talk about there are 309 million Americans, and we have about 1% of that population that are involved in producing food and fiber, and only a portion of that that's involved in animal agriculture. We as a country, we're blessed with abundant, safe, and affordable food. And the reality of how I was raised on a small family farm down in Pleasant Grove here in Utah, and we raised some pigs and some a couple of dairy cows, and we had a number of things there. And this was in the 60s. But that small family farm that had 5 or 10 acres, is not going to be able to meet the needs of 309 million Americans today. So agriculture, like banking, like a lot of other industries, has become more consolidated to be able to be more productive and meet the needs of American consumers, as well as we export almost 30% of what we produce in this country to feed hungry mouths in the global markets.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about a perception problem. I've talked to some people who I would describe as fairly neutral on the House Bill 187, who have expressed that there's at least a perception problem with 187, that it, and the phrase would be, what does agriculture have to hide?
I would agree with you that there's probably a lot of misinformation in that regard. Agriculture in Utah, and I would argue across the country, opens itself up to the consumers and the public. We have every year across the state of Utah, farms are visited by school children, thousands of school children from Cache County to Washington County will visit farming and ranching operations to get acquainted with what's going on those farms. You have to understand that people that in the dark of night visit these farms or do it in undercover are jeopardizing the biosecurity of these operations. That's the animal's health and its welfare that the farmers are charged with looking out for. We're concerned that these people that have an anti-meat driven agenda will find disgruntled or they'll cajole employees to produce footage that isn't truly representative of what's going on the farms. Those are the things that we're concerned about. We're talking about transparency here. We want transparency both ways, and we believe that the people that apply to work on farms should come onto those farms and be interviewed based on their understanding of animal husbandry practices, of animal care, and nothing less than that, not a hidden agenda.
There seems to be a disagreement between you and some animal rights groups, not just you, but agriculture, about the part of what the animal rights groups are calling abuse, and that is routine practices. Mr. Runkle brought up some routine practices, confined spaces. He brought up castrating young pigs or removing tails without painkillers. How do you view some of these routine practices?
And those have been proven to be, you can go on and talk about even Tom dehorning. There are those things that are done because they actually make the animal more amenable to working within a confined or in an area where there are a lot of other animals. Animals do have an aggressive tendency. As an example, poultry, when one they sense blood, they will peck another chicken to death, and so there's a practice called beak trimming. Well, the gentleman talked about that as being mutilating the animals. Well, and those are proven practices to allow these animals to exist in a structure where they're close together. The other piece of it is, and I've been around cattle, horses, sheep, and so forth, and I've you need to understand that these animals are under a tremendous amount of stress. They're not like your cat or your dog that are used to being managed and held, and giving them an anesthetic would make sense. These larger animals, the longer you hold them, the more stress they're under, and so the quicker you can get the operation done, that the needed management process, whatever that might be called, that's better for the animal. And to hold them and to wait, hold them in a confinement and wait for an anesthetic to take effect is ludicrous, and animals would die because of that added stress.
We just have about a minute left. We're talking with Randy Parker with the Utah Farm Bureau. And earlier we talked to Nathan Runkle for Mercy for Animals. A concluding question, Mr. Parker. If someone sees abusive animals or someone working on an agricultural operation, what is the process in place?
They need to report that. If they believe that there's an abuse of an animal and it doesn't meet a standard that is ethically that meets ethical standards, they should report that to the authorities. That's absolute.
And, of course, I'm guessing you believe Governor Herbert should sign 187.
We think that it should be signed, that it is, it's very narrow. It said that people should not, through fraudulent means, seek employment to malign animal agriculture. But all other actions, if you're outside of an operation on the street, or you can take pictures, there, all of those are protected, including the kids that come on and take pictures. This is a very narrow piece that says we want transparency on both sides of this ledger.
Very good. We've been talking with Randy Parker, CEO of Utah Farm Bureau. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And earlier in this half hour, we talked with Nathan Runkle, founder and executive director of Mercy for Animals, a debate on House Bill 187. After a commentary, we'll have Governor Gary Herbert on. I'll ask him directly about this bill and the sex ed bill 363. That's coming up.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
There's been a lot of talk about the 1% of the people who are supposed to be hoarding all the money and running for president. For many of us, they are a mystery. But years ago, I spent an evening with the 1%, and it was an experience I'll never forget. It happened when I lived in Seattle and was invited to go to a Mariners game with my friend Don. Don was a wise friend who laughed often, listened more than he talked, and always wore big boy pants. He read The New Yorker, all of it. And when he said he didn't watch much TV, I think he was telling the truth. I noticed when he talked about current events, he knew actual facts and could work them into the conversation. He had worked for a grown-up bank, a serious bank that never gives away toasters. It's like the bank of Mary Poppins, only the people are nice and the inside isn't dark and scary. There's no standing at a teller's window in this bank. You sit at a giant, expensive wood desk, and you make transactions with the help of the nice banker people who are your friends. When Don invited me to go to a Mariners game, we were excited and wondered how good our seats would be. We knew we were in a suite, but we weren't sure what that meant. When we got to the ballpark, we realized we didn't know how to get to the suites. We ended up in the outfield bleachers near the cheap seats we would usually sit in. When we showed the ushers our colorful, oversized suite tickets, they looked quite embarrassed for us, thinking that perhaps we might have suffered some mental trauma from mingling briefly with the 99% in the bleacher section. I waved goodbye. We were escorted to some glass doors, and I was afraid that the people would ask us some screening questions about executive compensation packages, offshore accounts, or Grey Poupon mustard. Instead, they treated us with great respect, inspected the tickets, and pointed the way. After two checkpoints, we were allowed to freely roam the quiet carpeted halls in search of our suite. I wasn't sure how I would act. All I knew about wealthy people was what I observed when I was bumped up into first class one time on an airplane. There I learned that, for some reason, people with lots of money have to gently dab their faces every hour or so with a warm, wet wash rag. I wanted to bring a wash rag with me in one of my pockets, but my wife said she didn't think that would help us create the image we were trying to cultivate. Don greeted us like we were important clients with lots of money to invest. We found the other real clients who had been invited to be remarkably pleasant and friendly. My wife is pretty, and it seems odd that she could be with me. I think they assumed I must be very wealthy. After the introductions, I quickly went to the railing to see the view. As I watched the Mariners warming up below, I had the strong impression that if I were to simply raise my hand in the air, like a Roman emperor, they would have immediately started the game. I also thought I might be able to have the umpires or any error-prone athlete removed just by standing and giving a thumbs-down gesture. I feared, however, if I did, they might just shoot the offending party and drag him off. I was sure that would put a damper on things. I did feel compassion as I saw the thousands of people below climbing over each other, spilling beer and nachos, and wedging themselves into their hard plastic seats. I felt pity for their situation, but not enough to share the free food I discovered. Yes, it's true. A sweet invitation comes with free food. Granted, much of it was in the form of dry, arty crackers and exotic dip, but it was very good. And they had these large hot dogs that were better than any I'd ever tasted before. It made me want to cry just to be in their presence. The problem with free food in this type of setting is that to be socially acceptable, you can't just pile up your plate like you're trying to drive the Royal Bucket Buffet restaurant into bankruptcy. It's a different feel. In fact, I eventually learned that there's no real need to stab someone with your fork, even if they reach for the same dry cracker that you wanted. It was very strange. It was all very civilized, and I instinctively knew that if we ran out of food, some new food would be brought in, perhaps hand-carried by a relief pitcher for the Mariners or Ichiro himself. The real challenge, therefore, was to try to casually sneak back to the free food 30 or 40 times during the game without people catching on to the fact that you were the one taking all the dry crackers and hot dogs. It was a remarkable evening. The Mariners actually won the game. Don called a cab after the game and had the driver drop us off at our car, which we had parked 22 miles away to save on parking fees. As we drove to our car, however, I noticed that Don pulled a wet rag from his suit coat pocket and began to dab it on his wrist. I looked to my wife as if to say, "See?" Don had a troubled look on his face, and he said, "The strangest thing happened tonight. I reached for a cracker, and someone stabbed me with a fork." This is Steve Eaton.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from Community Shares Utah, connecting donors with causes that matter through workplace giving to Utah charities, including Utah Public Radio and The Sharing Place. Information is at CommunitySharesUtah.org.
We're glad you're listening to Access Utah today, and hope you'll join us tomorrow. Sherry Quinn with Science Topics, and Monday, Brian Erlin with Gardening. On Tuesday, hope you'll join me an hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times business reporter Gretchen Morgenson, author of Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Next up, conversation that I recorded yesterday with Governor Gary Herbert. On this part of the program, we're pleased to be joined by Governor Gary Herbert, and we're going to take a legislative recap, look back at the session that was, and some issues going forward. Governor Gary Herbert, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's an honor to be with you.
First, let me get these two items out of the way. It's on a lot of people's minds, I'm sure. You know, there are petition drives on a couple of bills. One is House Bill 363, the sex education bill. The other is House Bill 187, which would prevent photographing farm operations without permission or under false pretenses. Have you made a decision on either of those bills?
I have not, and I'm going through the process and will be going through the process with these bills just like I do all bills. And there's about 490-plus of them that will be been passed that I need to review, and I have to review every one of them. And we'll go through and do our due diligence. We'll analyze them. We'll look for the consequences intended as well as the consequences unintended and try to decide whether they are good policy or not going forward. So with House Bill 363 and the agricultural bill, we'll treat them both the same, and I expect that we'll make a decision on both of those sometime next week.
What is the constitutional time frame that you have to look at those bills?
We have 20 days from the time that the legislature finishes. So I've got basically another, two and a half weeks.
And
March 29th, I think, is the actual last day.
I wonder if you could elaborate on the process. I guess you and staff pore over the bills.
Well, it's a complicated process. It's long and lengthy. We have introduced, for example, about 850 bills, and our office tracks them all. We work as we are able, proactively, with legislators to encourage them in a direction that we think is appropriate, as opposed to directions that we think are inappropriate. We believe that what that does is allow us to get good legislation passed without having to veto, down the road. So an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, kind of is the attitude we take. And in that process, I've got a general counsel and staff members that work with the legislators. out of that collection of bills, 850, then they passed about 490, and we are in the process of starting our review process on those, as I say, to analyze and see what the consequences, both intended and unintended, may be. Does it fit within the parameters of good public policy? What's in the best interest of Utah and Utah's families going forward? And that's the deliberative process I have to go through over that basically three-week period of time.
Do you generally defer to the legislature? How high a bar does it have to be? What are your criteria to actually veto a bill?
Well, you know, sometimes the legislature actually comes back and acknowledges to me we made a mistake. We've actually had the occasion over the past years where they've asked the governor to veto a bill, even though they've had an overwhelming majority that passed it. And most bills, frankly, the public might be surprised to know that most bills pass with an overwhelming margin bipartisanly. They don't make the news, though. It's just the few where there is some controversy and some emotion attached to it that make the news and that we mostly hear about. But of the 490-plus bills, there's probably 480 of them that are not of much controversy. You know, there's probably 400 of them that are almost unanimous in their passing. So, again, the legislature actually gets along, and they do their job well. They are diligent, good, intelligent people trying to find good policy for the people of Utah. So this legislative session, frankly, I think was one of the best we've had in many years.
I do want to get a general characterization of the session. Just one or two more questions on these bills. Petition drives like the ones on 187 and 363, how much weight does that carry with you?
Well, we certainly want to hear from our constituency, and we have, in these particular bills, there's emotion on both sides of them. And all sides of the bills, and we want to hear from the constituents to hear well-reasoned, articulate, you know, comments, which certainly factor into our decision process. At the end of the day, I've got to make a decision as the governor on what I think is good policy, but I get input from a lot of different sources, and certainly the public comment is part of it. So, again, it has a factor. It won't be the absolute thing. We have people ask me, well, have you checked the polls? What do the polls say? You know, this is not about politics. This is really about good policy. And my administration is about good policy, and the politics will be secondary.
So to recap this part, your constitutional part in this, you think you'll have decisions on most of this by what'd you say, end of next week?
I think by sometime next week we'll try to have a decision on both of these bills. We haven't received the bills yet from the legislature, but I expect they're in the pipeline and we'll be here in the next day or two. But I would hope to make a decision in a timely fashion and get on with governance and things we need to do that are probably just as important, if not more important.
We're recapping the 2012 legislative session. Governor Gary Herbert, of course, has a part in this. He reviews the bills. He may veto. I believe you can sign them, Governor, or you can let them go without your signature. I believe those are your three options.
Those are the three options. Mm-hmm. You said it right, Tom. I sign, I can veto, or let them go into law without my signature. Those are the options the governor has, and I understand how to do all three.
How would you characterize this 2012 session?
I think it's been a very good session. I think there's been a lot of collaboration and cooperation, a bipartisan effort on significantly important issues. I think we saw a minimum of rancor and a lot of civility and respect for each other's opinion. And consequently, I think we got a lot done. Sometimes a lot done is overshadowed by some of the controversial bills, but when you think of what we've done for education, for example, putting large amounts of money, nearly $120 million of new money into public education, that's a remarkable step forward from what we've done over the last 3 or 4 years. We put $56 million to higher ed, which has been cut the last 3 or 4 years. So prioritizing our budget and having education at the forefront, I think, shows a significant change of attitude with the legislature, a collaborative attitude, and it shows the fact that the economy now in Utah is growing and growing very well compared to the rest of the country, that we've turned the economy around, and with our unemployment dropping now to from a high of 8.3% to now it's 5.7%. The fact that our economy is growing at three times the national average, the fact that we're the second fastest state when it comes to job growth creation, has allowed us now to put more money into some of these very critical areas like education.
Are there things left undone, especially from your agenda going in, that were not done that you would have liked to have seen done in the 2012 session?
I think we covered most of my priorities. I think from my budget proposal and my issues on education, which was my top priority, and that along with growing the economy, virtually everything was covered. I asked, for example, a tax cut and made mention of that in my State of the State address, and I think we've got some good result there. In fact, even though there was misunderstanding when it was initially rolled out, when it was passed unanimously by Republicans and Democrats, and we're able to institute a tax cut with unemployment insurance rate cut that impacts all 85,000 businesses across our great state, allowing them to keep more money to reinvest in their business and hire more people. So that was a major coup for us, I think, for business and economic growth. Likewise, for our friends in rural Utah and up there in the beautiful Cache Valley, for example, we put together a funding mechanism for the Business Expansion Retention Program, sometimes referred to as the BEAR program, which is designed to really help expand and retain businesses that are off the Wasatch Front in the rural parts of our state, 25 counties that need some additional help. And, again, trying to make sure that our economy is healthy in all 29 counties and not just the Wasatch Front, this is a major step forward in helping grow the economy in rural Utah. So those are two areas I'm very proud of. One area that I think we missed an opportunity on is the immigration reform, particularly when it comes to the E-Verify. We have an E-Verify program. I think we have a kind of a cooperation and collaboration and consensus that we ought to strengthen the E-Verify program, which I think would be a step in the right direction of bringing people together on the immigration, the illegal immigration issue. And so that's maybe my only twinge that I wish we could have taken care of. The good news, though, is that we still have another session in 2013 to come back and address some of those things and, I think, improve the current immigration laws we have on the books.
I want to follow up on that. Of course, that was the hot issue in the 2011 session. Some have observed they thought the legislature didn't really want to go there again, you know, at least it's such a hot topic in the 2012 session. Do you think with the laws passed in the 2011 session, Utah has the right balance on immigration?
I felt good about it. That's why I signed the bills, and it really is a balanced approach. And I would just note this. You know, people can criticize whether it's 116 and with the guest worker permit that we're trying to get the federal government to grant to the state of Utah. I'm sure it's not perfect. I would be the first to stipulate that. But it was a good step in the right direction of a state that is saying we're tired and we're frustrated and we're angry because the federal government is not doing their job. And if you're not going to do their job, then states and Utah's at the forefront and says we're going to step up and do something. May not be perfect. We're going to do something because you're doing nothing. And that's kind of the genesis for it. But look at the results of what's taken place. As opposed to other states, and nobody's boycotting our businesses. Nobody's boycotting our conventions. Nobody is having their fruit and their crops rot in the fields like other states are having happen. Nobody's boycotting missionary programs for any of our churches and our faith-based organizations. We have got, in fact, good positive reviews from many other states and other governors, and we've got the attention of people in Washington, D.C. that are saying, gee, maybe Utah's on to something, and trying to get them off the sidelines and into the game. That's really the end goal here for all of this stuff, is to get the federal government to step up and take on their responsibilities as they should do under the Constitution. And so I think that we've had a fairly win-win-win-win-win all along the road. Is it perfect? No. Can there be improvements? Yes. And I expect there's some areas we can address in our upcoming legislative session. But by and large, we can stand tall in Utah that we've done what can be done appropriately in the state of Utah on a state-driven basis.
Do you generally support the series of bills which could be characterized by some as message bills, potentially with some financial cost to the taxpayers attached, which seek to rebalance state and federal power, including a bill which demands the federal government hand back much of the federal lands in Utah? You generally support those bills?
I do, and let me tell you why, Tom. I think all of us recognize, and I can tell you this recognition as I work with other governors across the country, Democrats as well as Republicans are recognizing the significant overreach of the federal government into state domain. We are sovereign states, and we have responsibilities, and we should have opportunities to do our own thing. We are laboratories of democracy. And this federal overreach, which is becoming very costly and adding to our national debt, has got to be pushed back. And so whether it's on health care reform, on Medicaid reform, whether it's on education issues, or whether it's on our public land, you know, there ought to be a pushback, and there ought to be an idea that, look, things ought to be better. We are a state that is significantly disadvantaged because we are not and have not been treated like most other states in the union. We have a lot of public land here. It's a blessing and it's a curse. It certainly stymies our ability to develop economically. It's a blessing because we have wonderful landscapes that we, in fact, want to keep and preserve. But sometimes the federal government's overreach inhibits our ability to ranch and to farm. It inhibits our ability for our extraction resources, our natural resources. And it's really hurting us significantly in our ability to develop our energy. So, yeah, I support it. We want to increase the dialogue and have a better understanding as we have a shared responsibility of states and federal government, and see if we can't, in fact, have a more level playing field that gives us economic opportunity that's been given to other states. And the bottom line on all this is that if we can't grow the economy, that means we have less income tax, which means we have less money for education.
Are you concerned about the potential costs here? This could be litigated, some of these bills, on into the future.
Well, anytime you end up going to court, there's a cost. And you know, what is the cost to the benefit? The benefit, we hope, is going to be an improved environment where we, in fact, have more economic opportunity for farmers, ranchers, energy developers, and other folks in industry. And I believe we can get a process in place that gives us more opportunities to have multiple use of the public lands and not inhibit our industry folks. So the cost will only be if we end up having to go to court to assert those rights. And I think that the cost to the benefit is, in fact, a good ratio. My hope is, like the old adage about, you know, get the donkey's attention by slapping upside the head with the two before, maybe we're going to get the federal government's attention in a more reasonable, rational way here to say, look, maybe we should sit down and work with you on this, and with our negotiation and potential for legislation, get an improved environment. But the stick that's getting their attention is going to be the litigation.
And finally, I know we have to let you go here. The health care compact, do you support that? This would petition Congress to move a lot of health care services off the federal government level and to the states.
Absolutely. I can tell you that states are much more efficient, much more effective in the delivery of services than is the federal government. The more we can have the states take it on, the better it'd be. We could cut taxes for the taxpayer and give better services. We, in fact, as a state, have demonstrated with Medicaid reform. I took and we are the leading state, the first state, to go paperless on Medicaid. Well, it saves our taxpayers about $6.3 million. But we had pushback from the federal government that says, oh, we don't want you to do that. But we've persistent. We've got now a waiver to allow us to do this. And other states are going to copy us on this and save their taxpayers money. That's just one example of many of where we need to say to the federal government, look, we'll take less money. You block grant the money to us, take away the strings and the red tape, and let us be more innovative and more creative. We can do more with less if the federal government would give us the right to do it, take away the strings, and block grant the money to us. That's what we're talking about with this health care.
And just one more question. Higher education, how do you think higher education fared this session? Any other needs you see going forward?
Well, very well. $56 million in new money to higher education, and that's a significant step in the right direction. It's part and parcel of our efforts to, in fact, have post-high school education become the norm, not the exception. And right now, it's K through 16 rather than K through 12. But it's also our applied technology colleges. There's great opportunity in the marketplace for technicians, for electricians, machinists. You know, those trades that are out there that provide great livings and great opportunity and help you pay the bills. And so we have a goal in the state right now we call it 66 by 2020, that we want to have by the year 2020 that 66% or two-thirds of our adult population ages 20 through 64 will have some kind of post-high school certification or degree. My belief in having that goal is because if we don't reach that goal by 2020, our economy will underperform. So that's why we're emphasizing not only public education, K through 12, but now higher education, because our goal to reach that 66 by 2020 will not be reached if we don't have post-high school education. And that's going to be a necessity for us to, in fact, continue to grow our economy.
Very good. We've been talking with Utah Governor Gary Herbert doing a 2012 legislative session recap. Governor, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you. Look forward to talking with you again soon.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the Cache Valley Center for the Arts, presenting the touring production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Tony Award-winning Cats, April 3rd and 4th at 7:30 p.m. Ticket information is at centerforthearts.us.